And we're going to continue from verse 6. We talked about verse 6 last week, but it does go with what I want to talk about today. Last week we spoke about how, first of all, Christ became better than the angels. He's always been better than the angels, but what it meant in particular was in his humanity. What Jesus did is he elevated humanity above the angels, do you see? And of course, that is the completed work of Christ, the second coming of Christ, when, you know, the very reason for him coming into the world is consummated. Became better than the angels, firstly. Christ, the angels, and, it might seem strange, but the Davidic covenant. Why the Davidic covenant? Why would the author of Hebrews throw that in there? Well, simply because of Jesus' reign, by which he reigns upon earth. We spoke about that, and then Christ is worshipped by the angels and will be worshipped by the angels. And I threw in it needs to be stressed, or at least thought about, that angels in the context of Hebrews 1 is again not so much worshipped by the angels now as he sits in heaven. That happens. Worship by the angel, he comes. And think about it. So, continuing on to today, focus on the rest of what Hebrews says. This is somewhat of an artificial outline that I've got. An hour and a half, 2 hours, and you'll be all fast to finish. But as the heir of David, he says, let all the worship him. This is speaking to the angels, worship the Son. And as I've just said, or at least much more. And I think of that because of two, if we can't see them, do you see? I mean, that would be a bit of a comedy, wouldn't it? Pronouncing on someone you couldn't see. So you see, I think we need to envisage the coming kingdom in this expanded way. That it might challenge us and it might seem to be weird and extremely strange to us. But it's only strange because of our present limited circumstances, do you see? So it says, let the angels of God worship him. And verse 7, of the angels, he says, so now God is speaking to the angels, who makes his angels spirits and his ministers, excuse me, who are the angels, a flame of fire. This is a description of the angels. They dash about doing God's will. And in fact, in verse 14, it says, are not they, that is the angels, all ministering spirits? Ministering spirits. They're not sat on thrones. They're going about doing the bidding of God. But they're doing more than that. Sent forth to minister for those, or on behalf of those, who will inherit salvation. That's you. That's me. Do you see that? They are ministering to us. Now again, I want to point this out to you if it hasn't crossed your mind. If the angels are ministering to us and will, in the kingdom, minister to us even more, then surely what this tells us is that the creation which was made for Adam and Eve, it was made for mankind. That's why Jesus became a man, yes? That kingdom will even more be governed, or under the dominion of mankind. With angels who were created for that, to help that dominion, to move it forward, to minister to us as we do God's bidding as his vice regents in the coming new heavens and new earth. I hope that you can capture just a little bit of what that means. And what it clearly means is that the limitations that we have now will be nothing, or rather will be expanded hugely, greatly, beyond what we can conceive. But I said this passage is mainly addressing the throne of the Son, and we can see that as it moves forward. Verse 8, after addressing the angels, it says, to the Son, he, God, says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. Now this is why the angels can worship him. The angels couldn't worship somebody who was not God. Do you see that? God will not allow anyone else to be worshipped who is not God. Which tells us that Jesus is divine. Your Jesus must be God. Or you have a false Jesus. It is God who was manifested in the flesh. It was God who came and became a man. God the Son. That is the astonishing truth that the gospel speaks to us about. And it is only because God became man that we stood any chance of being redeemed. Because God was the judge. God was the standard that we had to reach. Nobody else could set that standard or achieve that standard. It had to be God, and it was. Your throne, this is the coming throne of Christ. Yes, in Jerusalem. Yes, in Israel. Yes, governing the whole world. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. It's not some kind of airy-fairy spiritual throne up there in heaven. That's not where the throne of David is. It is a real physical throne in a real physical world down here. This world, this creation, is the center of God's plans. We've been told by scientists for hundreds of years about the Copernican principle. You know what the Copernican principle is? The Copernican principle is that the earth is not at the center of the universe. It's not at the center of anything. It's just an insignificant planet in an insignificant solar system, in an insignificant galaxy among billions of other galaxies. That is not the picture of the Bible. That is not the picture the Bible paints of this earth. This world is the most significant place in the cosmos. This is where the King will reign from. Heaven eventually will come down to earth. Your throne is forever and ever. Can you imagine the transformation. It's going to talk about a change in a second. But can you imagine the transformation that we'll have to, this world will have to go through? I mean, it's more than just, putting a car through a car wash and, detailing it a little bit. And saying, oh, that's nice. You know, I didn't know it would look that nice just with a little bit of polish on it and so on. No, that's not going to be enough for God. That's not going to be enough for the glorious reign of the Son of God who made and upholds this world and who will reign over this world. Do you think that will be enough? Absolutely not. This world will be astonishingly glorious. But more than just glorious, it says a scepter of righteousness is the scepter of your kingdom. Now that is an allusion to two passages in the Old Testament. One of them in Genesis 49, which is that prophecy of Jacob over Judah. And the other one in the book of Numbers. And both of them, that's the Balaam's prophecy, as I see a star and a scepter and so on. But not now. He will come, but not now. That prophecy. And both of those say that, yes, he will rule, but he will rule in righteousness. He will rule justly. Everything, every decision he makes, every communication that he will have, every law, as it were, that he enacts will be a just and a righteous law, a fair law. Everybody will be treated perfectly, fairly, but righteousness is more than just good laws. Righteousness also means everything that comes with it. Goodness, beauty, love. Light. That will distinguish also the kingdom. And when there is good and when there is beauty and when there is light, there will be peace. And if the curse is removed from that kingdom, then what remains is this all-suffusing beautiful righteousness, then there cannot be any more tears or crying or sorrow or pain. Do you see? Verse 9 says, you have loved righteousness. It's not that he is forced to be righteous or forced to rule in a righteous way. The kings were told to do that in the Old Testament. It is that he loves righteousness. It is that righteousness is part of who he is. It's what he does. It's how he acts. You hate lawlessness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you, and this is figurative speech here, with the oil of gladness more than your companions. This speaks to what? Celebration, rejoicing, gaiety, laughter, smiles, joy. I'm trying to paint a picture of the coming kingdom here, using these words from the writer to the Hebrews. Is this the kind of kingdom that you expect? Is this the kind of kingdom that you want? Do you think that you wouldn't do very well in a kingdom that was so righteous, a kingdom that was so joyous? Do you think people have a better time in hell? Some people are foolish enough to think that. I'll be with my friends in hell. Okay. First of all, your friends won't be your friends in hell. Okay. Secondly, if you're suffering and you're in pain and you are gnashing your teeth, you won't have any time for your friends. It's very different when you're feeling healthy and you're feeling good and you can sin all you like with your friends and no, you think nobody's going to touch you. It's very different than when the finger of God does touch you and your calamity does come upon you. Then there's no freedom to be with your friends. No, there's no freedom to sin anymore. To think what you want to think. There's only regret. And the feeling that you are a supreme fool for despising the cross and the sacrifice of Christ that was made for you. God has anointed you with the oil of gladness more than your companions. So there is a picture of the kingdom, the picture of the throne of Christ. Verses 10 to 12 speak about the permanence of this situation. And you, Lord, in the beginning laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you remain. They will grow old like an old garment. Like a cloak, you will fold them up and they will be changed, but you are the same and your years will not fail. The author of Hebrews has a way of coming round, mentioning a subject, then leaving it and coming round to it again. It started off by saying that everything was created by the Son, or through the Son, and is upheld by the word of his power. It's coming back to it again here. From the beginning, you laid the foundation. Jesus laid the foundation. And yet Jesus was the stone which the builders rejected, wasn't he? How ironic. The heavens are the work of your hands. And so he is the creator. Though naturally, therefore, the present heavens and the earth will have to undergo some kind of renovation, at the very least. They will perish. All of this, all of the monuments that man has built up upon it, all of the things that and places that we go to and we marvel at, perish. They're not good enough. They're good enough for us now, but they won't be good enough for us when we're glorified. They're not good enough for the Son when he comes to reign in his everlasting reign. They perish, you remain. They will all grow old like a garment. Well, if you're anything like me, I'm not very good at noticing when my clothes are growing old. So I will wear a t-shirt forever and ever, okay? Until Gina points out to me, you know, that thing is baggy, that thing is full of holes, that thing, just get rid of it. You look awful in that. Jesus, though, when he comes back, we'll notice that this is like an old coat. This world, this sin-cursed world, it won't do. It's got to change. Like a cloak, you will fold them up and they will be changed. Now, some people believe, and I think they have grounds for this, and I think I'm one of them. Some people believe that this present world will be consumed, will be completely destroyed, and a new heavens and new earth will be recreated. I tend to go with that based on 2 Peter chapter 3 and Revelation, the book of Revelation chapter 20. But there are others, and they're good people, and I think they have also a good point, who speak about the complete renovation of this planet. And that could be too. The reconciliation of those verses is possible. I think it's more possible under my understanding of it than others, but there we are. We'll soon see, won't we? Whatever God wants to do is fine with me, but we do know it's going to be radical. We do know it's going to be a big transformation, because the reign of Christ, the reign of the Son, is going to be a permanent reign of glory, a permanent reign of joy, a permanent reign of peace and righteousness. That's hard for me to grasp right now, because I'm used to anything but that. And you think, well, surely some of it's going to creep in. You know, surely some unrest, some displeasure, some discomfort. I just can't imagine a world without that. Because I bump into it every day. Well, I can't imagine it, not too well, but I believe that God is able to bring it to pass. Why? Because he's perfect. Because he is able to do that. He's able to work everything out so that we can be in a perfect freedom without any sin or any thought of sin, and yet we will be freer than any sense of freedom we could have down here right now. We will be ourselves much more than is possible here and now. This is a kingdom that's made for us, remember. And so we wait for the Son. This is what verses 13 and 14, particularly verse 13, speaks to. God has spoken about the reign of the Son, the permanence of the Son. Now verse 13, there's a rhetorical question. To which of the angels has he ever said, and then this is said to the Son, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool? This is Psalm 110. Has he ever said that to any angel? No, and he never will. That was never his intention. The angels are, verse 14, ministering spirits. That's their station. And they're perfectly content doing that. But there's more exalted place for the Son. And there's a more exalted place for those who are in the Son. And so we wait for him. We wait until Christ and the are made his footstool. Christ has many enemies. Many enemies in our world today, many very powerful people, many very wealthy people, many people who believe that because they have that power and wealth and influence, that they can get away with whatever they want to get away with. And for the time being, they are doing it. They are getting away with it. Well, God will let them get away with it for 30, 40, 50 years. What's 30, 40, 50 years when you compare it to an eternity? What is 1 inch when you compare it to 1,000,000 miles? They can have their 30, 40 years because they will have the judgment of God, the judgment of the Son that comes after it. They will be made the footstool of the Son. Now, this is rather a as it were, graphic illustration, because what this means, alludes to what happened in the ancient world, where when you defeated a foe, for many kings anyway, they would actually take the king, the ruler, and they would make them kneel down and they would put their feet on him and literally make the ruler a footstool. You know, they wouldn't put a poof there or something made for the job. They'd have a human being there. Now, I'm not saying that Jesus will literally have human beings with his feet up upon them, but you get the idea, yes? They will be humbled. They will be brought low. Will be exalted. Jesus will be the king. Jesus is the one who will have his will and his way. Jesus is the one who will never be stopped. But that's fine. Because who wants to stop a perfect reign of peace and of joy and of righteousness? Who wants to stop being in that fellowship? Broadening it for eternity, because God, as God is eternal, there is eternal work to be done, and it's all good work. It's all fruitful work. It's all satisfying. So here God is speaking to the Son. The Father speaking to the Son. And when he's saying these kinds of things to the Son, you can be quite sure that he's not exaggerating. And he's not bluffing. This kingdom is coming. It's coming. Christ is far exalted than any angel. Christ right now, but Christ in his return and in his throne and in his reign. Christ as our King, as our brother and as our friend. Let's pray. Dear Father, you have spoken to the Son these great words of promise. He has suffered and he has endured and he has come out of it victoriously and has brought many sons to salvation. And again, like we prayed earlier, we ask, Lord, that you will hasten the day for the return of Christ. This is how the author to the book of Hebrews begins his book, by pointing out the outstanding glory of the kingdom to come. May it come. May it come soon. For Christ's name's sake, Amen.